to Number 9 Podcast. I'm Jessie Cox, and today we're going to be continuing with our discussion on sleep. But today we're going to be looking at the ages of children aged between 2 and 5. And I am delighted to say that we are joined again today by Rosie Davidson, who is the founder and CEO of Just Chill Baby Sleep, which is an infant sleep consultancy based on providing straightforward, evidence-based sleep advice to parents. As a successful businesswoman and a content creator with a large social media following, Rosie gives an insight into her work as a sleep consultant, entrepreneur, and busy parent to her 3 children. So Rosie, we're going to be continuing on our sleep podcast, and now we're going to be looking at ages kind of 2 years to 5, just before they go to school, or possibly even just that first year of school. If you haven't managed to get your baby into a routine and they've had just awful sleep through the night, is it too late? Is it game over? Or are there things that we can do to improve sleep quality?
It's absolutely never too late. We can always work on sleep, whether that's children, teenagers, adults, elderly. There's always ways we can approach sleep to improve it. So, and please don't, a lot of people feel like really embarrassed or ashamed or guilty that, you know, their 3, 4-year-old, 5-year-old still isn't sleeping through the night. And they kind of think, you know, oh, everyone's thinking it should have happened by now.
Mm. And it can be hard to get help, really, can't it? Because if you feel embarrassed, you don't really want to let everybody else know. We talked about this on the last podcast a little bit, but at what age should we really be trying to get these naps over and done with?
Okay, so naps, dropping naps, it does vary, but I would say we want to kind of be thinking about definitely being on one nap by 18 months. So we kind of gone past that. So this kind of age range, they're either going to be doing one nap or no naps. So approaching that 1 to 0 nap transition, we call it, can be quite tricky. Mm. And it's a bit of a balance. If they started to fight bedtime, and before they were going to bed kind of okay, or bedtime's taking a really long time, maybe think about shortening that nap or moving the timing of it slightly. Also, another sign that you might need to change it is that they've started to wake up really early. Because what will happen is they're waking up earlier and earlier, then they use that nap, that long nap that they don't necessarily need anymore, to catch up on that sleep. So if we look at sleep across 24 hours, we can see, okay, maybe they're taking 10 hours overnight, but they're taking 2.5 hours in the day. So you start thinking, okay, that's 12 and a half hours out of 24. If they're 3 years old, that's probably not appropriate. They probably don't need that nap anymore. And then you'll get that nice solid 12 hours or 11 hours, depending. And not all children will do a 12-hour night. That's also a bit of a myth. So some will only sleep for 10 hours overnight. So it's a bit of a balance. But the age range generally for going to no nap can be anything. I'd say the average is age 2 to 4. But most little ones, probably around 2.5, maybe 3, are dropping to no nap.
And it can be really hard when they drop that nap, because they can be challenging, shall we say. Is there anything that you can do to help them in that kind of transition of getting rid of all their naps?
Yeah, I always introduce quiet time. So after they've had their lunch, have some quiet time. I mean, I'm not one for really recommending loads of TV, but it might be the time you put on like a really calm TV show or a calm, like kind of Disney movie or something. You cuddle up on the sofa together and have that quiet time. Or it might be that you read stories, you do puzzles, some kind of play just to bring everything down a little bit, you know, if they're everywhere, running everywhere. Because sometimes when they're tired, they can get a bit overstimulated, as I said on the last podcast. So we want to kind of encourage them to calm a little bit and have some quiet time, so that maybe they might not be sleeping, but they might just be kind of having a rest and a bit of a time out to help them get all the way through to bedtime. Because it's quite a long time to go from, you know, if you were used to having that nap after lunch to then having nothing and getting all the way through. And it might be that temporarily you do a slightly earlier bedtime.
That's a good idea.
I wouldn't again swing too far, because
4 o'clock.
Then you can end up with a little one getting up really early. So if you put them to bed at 6, they might wake up at 5 because they've had 11 hours. But You might think if they normally go to bed at 7:30, maybe a 7 o'clock bedtime, or if they normally go to bed at 7, maybe quarter to, just, make it, nudge it that little bit earlier while they're adjusting. And some of them, while they're dropping it, they might do a nap one day and not the next. And sometimes they alternate days. Or some little ones in nursery, I find, might drop it at nursery where there's loads going on and they're really busy. And then on a Saturday or a Sunday, you might find that they still do a nap.
We haven't really touched on this up to now. Can you talk to us a little bit about twins? I mean, do you need to treat them the same or are they different? What's your advice concerning getting twins to
But
sleep?
wait, in terms of sleep, all the advice that I've given is exactly the same, but you find there's more than one of them. However, when we're looking at the twins themselves, we need to look at them as individuals. So it might be that they have slightly different sleep needs, but the easiest way to approach it is assume that they have the same sleep needs and then only adjust if you need to. So if you're thinking about a routine, we want to try and get them on roughly the same routine to make everyone's lives easier. But if you're having problems at bedtime, I tend to say if you're trying to settle both of them, settle the easier twin first and then go to the more tricky twin, or triplet. I've helped lots of multiples, so that then you've got more time with that child to try and help settle them.
That's really good advice. And can we talk a little bit about when we should be moving children out of cots? I know for me, I just didn't want to get them out of the cot. I just felt like it was the time that I could keep them where they were. And the minute I took that cot away, it was game over. But when should we really be taking them into a big bed?
So I think there's a lot of pressure around moving them out. This is what I hear from parents, and there really is no rush to do it. So as long as they're comfortable, they're safe, and they're not climbing out, you can leave them in there really until they're too big for it. So people rush out, and the thing is, with toddlers, they don't have something called impulse control. It's not developed. So the longer you can keep them in their cot, the more likely this transition is going to be smooth and they'll stay in bed. Otherwise, a lot of them will just jump straight out of bed once you put them in. And parents have said to me, I moved them out because I thought they hated their cot and it was going to make sleep better. But actually, sleep changes, if you're going to make them, tend to be easier when they're in the cot. So I mean, the thing is, we have to keep in mind safety. So if your little one is climbing out, it's no longer safe. So I would consider moving them into a bed of some sort, whether it's a toddler bed or a single bed, whatever you've decided. But maybe think about, are they wearing a sleeping bag? Because the sleeping bag will stop them from climbing out. That's another one.
And what do you do when they're at that age where they're not in a sleeping bag anymore because they don't fit them, and they are getting out of the bed, you put them down and they're constantly jumping back up again?
So it's really tricky and really challenging. But again, referring back to all the other things I've said, think about, is their routine age appropriate? Do they need to drop a nap? Do they need a later bedtime? If you've covered all that off and you're like, I know they're tired, this is age appropriate, they are ready for bed. We've done all, again, with toddlers as well, this connection cup, filling this connection cup before bed is really, really helpful, helping them unwind. It might be, physically, so physical kind of exercise or calming things, whatever calms them. If you've done all of that, then it is a case of just returning them and holding your boundary. Children don't push boundaries because they don't want them there. They push boundaries because it's part of what toddlers do. And actually, it makes them feel safe and secure if we hold a loving boundary. We don't need to do it in a mean way. We can do it in a loving way. I always say to parents, stay calm. Keep it brief. You don't have to do any of this stuff that people talk about, like no eye contact, like ignore that. You can engage with your child, but keep it bright, keep it breezy. Say it's time to bed. It's time for bed now, tonight, as if you've said it the first time, even if it's the 50th time. And you just keep returning them. And I promise you, they will eventually get the picture and just say, okay, this is where I sleep.
I love what you've just said about boundaries because, I so agree with that. That's fantastic. Thank you so much. Can we talk about the multiple requests when they're older for I'm thirsty, I'm hungry, I need a wee? Can we talk a little bit about that at bedtime?
Okay, yes, this is really common. So if this is you listening, please, you are not alone. First of all, think about, again, as I said, filling this cup, this connection cup, because sometimes it's them trying to get that connection, because bedtime might be the only time all day where they really get you to themselves. If you think about it, you might have been rushing out to work in the morning, you've been apart for a lot of the day, then you were doing dinner, you were clearing up dinner, you're here, there, and everywhere. This is their time to get you. So they're going to do this. So if you can have some time set aside, even if it's 5 minutes, just one-on-one with no distractions before your bedtime routine, a bit of child-led play, I call it. So letting them lead, you're just almost an observer where you're commenting on what they're doing, that kind of thing, or you set up some calm sort of plays and puzzles or whatever that they like. Fill the connection cup first. If you know you've done that, you know they've got an age-appropriate bedtime, then thinking about ticking off all the potential requests before bedtime. So
Okay.
they've had a wee, you've agreed on two stories, you stick to two stories, and that is your boundary. If you've said to them, this is what we're doing, if they've had a drink, they've had a drink. You've done all of this before, so it kind of negates that. Another thing that I think is really helpful is a bedtime routine chart. So you might have, it could be one that you make together. They could design it themselves, or you can print one off and have it next to their bed or on the back of their door or something, so they can have a visual to know these are the things we do in this order and this is how it goes. And then it can end like there's one of them, like smiley face in their bed. Because sometimes children, again, are like pushing back because they need that security of knowing what's happening now and what's happening next and where we're going to.
That's really good advice. Can you talk to me a bit about this surge of energy that children seem to have after dinner, and kind of before you start, the routine for us? We always do a bath in our bedtime routine, but it seems to me that they have this, they were really tired and you're pushing them on to have their dinner, and then all of a sudden they've got a whole new lease of life. How do you
Yeah,
handle that?
this is really normal, and I always say, like, I always talk about getting those last sillies out. So you might have like a mini trampoline in your home, or you do a little obstacle course with cushions in your front room. It depends what they're like if they're kind of like to wrestle, or rough housing, and I mean that in a nice, like, appropriate way, consensual way. Or it might be that you do massage or yoga or something just to get these last bits of sillies out so that the body can relax. But I want you to know that it's really normal for this to happen, and actually we might not notice it, but adults have it as well. And in theory, it's to do with prehistoric times when we might have been out hunting or gathering all day, and just as it starts to get dark, we need to get the energy to get back to camp.
Oh,
So it gives us
wow.
that last boost. It's really interesting. But it's really, really normal for children to do this. So I would say, rather than kind of fighting it, and if you do have a child who's like this, think about allowing them to let that energy out. And especially if you have a neurodivergent child, it might be that some other kind of sensory input's really helpful. So I like to do row, row your boat with your feet pressed against one another. So you get the rocking motion and you also get the pressing, which a lot of them are looking for physical feedback. It might be that you do some kind of more sensory game, so like putty, or threading beads sometimes. All these kind of things can help unwind. And even you can do really fun stuff around smells. So, like if you have essential oils on different ones or different hankies, see what they like. And there's lots of fun things we can do to help wind down.
Is taking, I mean, like we said, we're recording in the summer months. Is taking children outside when it's still so light, close to bed, is that a bad thing to do? Does it just wake them up further, confuse the body?
I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing, but I think it's a case of experimenting. So there's weighing up, getting that last bit of kind of physical energy out. But also, I mentioned it briefly earlier, melatonin, one of our sleep hormones, starts to come out as it gets dark. And some children might, that might happen later, especially if they have ADHD. Children with ADHD, the melatonin is produced actually 90 minutes later than your neurotypical child. So for those children, or children who particularly find light more stimulating than others, because we're all different, I would be drawing the curtains at home and trying to make it darker ahead of bedtime a bit earlier. But some children might be able to tolerate light right up until they go to sleep and they just pass out and they're happy.
As you're talking about these hormones, there's obviously a lot of melatonin, magnesium foot rubs. I mean, my Instagram's covered in adverts.
Oh, yeah.
What's your opinion on those?
Okay, so two different categories. One, melatonin. So melatonin, synthetic melatonin. So melatonin is a hormone that's produced in our pineal gland. It happens naturally as it gets dark. But actually, interestingly, the light from the day stimulates our brain to store melatonin, and then the melatonin is released around the time it gets dark. So lots of light input in the day actually naturally increases melatonin.
Wow.
So especially for those who might be autistic children who produce potentially less melatonin or in a different way, lots of light exposure is really helpful. But that's an aside. So we've got natural melatonin and we've also got synthetic melatonin. Synthetic melatonin in the UK, you can get on prescription from your paediatrician. It's normally used in neurodivergent children. However, I don't think it should be used unless we've done all the other stuff. So we need to do the sleep hygiene, the routine and behavioural intervention before we consider medicating. There's a couple of reasons. One, because if we're using synthetic melatonin long term, it can have an impact on our natural melatonin production. Synthetic melatonin can also have an impact on other systems in the body, one being the reproductive system later in life. I don't want to scare anyone, because for the right child in the right circumstance, melatonin can be transformative. But we need to remember that melatonin will only help with sleep onset, which is falling asleep. It doesn't keep us asleep. It's not a sedative. So it helps the body know that it's time to fall asleep, but it doesn't do anything else. But you might find with an autistic child who was spending hours trying to get them to sleep, they fall asleep much quicker. And even that, for that family who's been really struggling, might be worth it. We need to weigh up everything. And that's why in the UK, you have to get it under the guidance of a paediatrician. So we're weighing up everything. We're looking at history. What's quite frightening is in the US and other countries, you can get melatonin gummies over the counter. The thing that's really scary about those is when they've been tested, the dosage varies wildly.
Oh, gosh.
So they might say there's a dosage on there, but whether the dosage is actually that dosage, it could be a lot less. It could be a lot more. And there are some of those that have been tested and they're 10 times the amount they should be having.
Oh, gosh.
They also have other things in them. And then we're not able to regulate the use. And normally, you know, if you were medicating under the guidance of a paediatrician, you'd be reassessing and looking at everything on a regular basis, having catch-ups. And, you know, with any medication, there's always risks involved. So we kind of want to be very considered. So I find it quite frightening that they're available over the counter. But that's why they're not in this country. But I don't want anyone to think I'm demonising melatonin, because it can be, like I said, a real game changer for some neurodivergent children. When it comes to magnesium is talked about a lot, unfortunately, because there's very, very little evidence that it has any impact on sleep in terms of supplementation. So magnesium is something that helps the brain and body relax. But for children to be deficient is very, very unusual.
Wow.
And if they were deficient and they were showing worrying symptoms of being unwell or something else, then I'd advise seeing a doctor and getting a blood test. But when it comes to foot rubs and things, there's actually no evidence that magnesium will penetrate the skin.
Love that. Amazing.
So the foot rubs are probably a no, but they can be a placebo, and I'll tell you why, because to have a nice little foot massage as part of your bedtime routine can be relaxing, and it can be one of these predictable steps as part of your routine to help you unwind.
Yeah.
So that's great. Supplements in terms of like oral supplements, again, there's hardly any research on magnesium being effective unless you were deficient, and then you would supplement until you weren't deficient anymore, and then you'd stop. So like any supplement, you don't want to be taking anything you don't actually need. So I'd be saying to that parent, maybe think about everything else I've spoken about, routine behavioral interventions, and speaking to somebody like me to think, okay, what can we look at? And yeah, diet is important, to have a healthy, balanced diet, but no one food will make your child sleep unless, for example, I don't know, they were anemic and they needed more iron.
Yeah, I love what I've been seeing on your Instagram where you're like, don't be putting a pureed apple into a bottle. It's
Oh
not
gosh,
the
no.
magic trick.
No.
Can you tell me, in your opinion, what are like the top mistakes that you see parents making with children and sleep?
It's a tricky one because I don't like kind of to demonize what parents are doing in terms of like, I think that we're all just trying our best, aren't we? But if we think about what are the things we can be doing, we can be working towards, if you want it, this kind of holy grail of independent sleep. And if you want your child to fall asleep without your help or with minimal help, where you give them a kiss and a cuddle and you say good night, we need to maybe make changes. And I think a lot of parents are hesitant because they think that they're going to do harm, or if a child is upset, that means they've done something wrong. Sometimes children do get upset just because they're pushing back and just because things are changing.
So, with that in mind, what would be your top tips that you could do to improve your child's sleep tonight?
Okay, think about what they are like, what their personality is. Again, age range. So it might be, let's just say we're looking at like a 2-year-old. Make sure that that nap is appropriate. If they don't need it, or you think they might not, shorten their nap or make their bedtime a little bit later. Fill their connection cup before bed. Make sure you've ticked off all those requests. If they're going to get in and out of bed, keep returning them, hold that boundary. Or if you want to change and you were, I don't know, holding their hands asleep and you don't want to do that anymore, just before they fall asleep, start removing that hand each night. Get them more and more used to falling asleep themselves.
Yeah, so not just going, right, that's it, you're on your own, shutting the door and
Yeah,
walking off.
exactly.
Okay. Rosie, I love some of the things that you've said today. It's been such a jam-packed podcast. I love what you said also about creating boundaries and rhythms for our children. I just think that's so helpful. Thank you so much for your time.
You're so welcome.
And we really hope you'll come again and talk to us in the future. And to our wonderful parents that are listening, thank you so much for your time. And don't forget that if you would like to access some of Rosie's online courses or one-to-one consultancy, you can do that with a special number 9 discount. The information will either be in the show notes or on our website for our parents. Thank you so much for your time, and we wish you all the best.